Hello, welcome to the Hoop Collective Podcast. Andrew, what am I supposed to say?
It's Brian Windhorst from the Hoop Collective. I would say out of what does it sound like? Does it sound like I'm in a tunnel or something?
Yeah, but I like that. It gives you it makes it sound like you're coming in from the booth.
This is where I'm relegated to after just not believing in my Clippers.
That's right.
That's what happened.
That's right. What are we supposed to do also?
You're supposed to subscribe, rate, and review this fine podcast and the many fine podcasts that ESPN, ESPN.com, ESPN the app. Brian Windhorst.
ESPN the app. So we've got with us from Seattle, got up early, although I wonder if he sleeps. Do you think the machine sleeps? It's the machine, Kevin Pelton. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
I'm good. I can confirm it's early, and I do sleep.
Okay. And joining us in Oklahoma City is Mr. Royce Young, celebrating both Baker Mayfield's performance and Oklahoma Sooners victory, barely beating West Virginia on Saturday. Are you still celebrating those two momentous events?
I am. You know, as a lifelong Browns fan, yesterday was a great day for us, Brian. It was felt good. Felt good to watch that.
Yeah. I am a little bit conflicted. So Royce and I are potentially going to be at odds over the next week because I really do think that the last spot in the playoff for the college football playoff, which you can see on ESPN on December 29th, is going to come down to Ohio State or Oklahoma. And I'm not sure. Maybe finishing fifth, having righteous indignation about how you were screwed by the committee and not getting beat by Bama isn't the worst thing to do in the world. But at the same time, Ohio State finished fourth in the playoff 1 year and ended up winning it. So, things happen.
Who's Ohio State's third string quarterback this year, though, Brian? That's the question.
We haven't gotten that point, but we have used our second string quarterback a few times. Our first string quarterback should be in New York for the Heisman, but that's neither here nor there. So, guys, it's November 26th. We're 6 weeks into the season. Some teams have played more than 20 games. Some teams have played as few as 17 games. But we are kind of at the somewhat magic number of 20 games, which you know, am I correct in saying this, Pelton, has been somewhat predictive in years past, kind of who you are at 20 games? Granted, if you trade for a guy at midseason that's an all-star, it changes it. But kind of what you are at 20 is what you are. Is that – am I somewhat right on that, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, there is no the one magic number. But when you look at kind of – there's kind of a chart where how predictive your results so far of the rest of the season – it's after about 25 games in particular, it starts to level off and you don't necessarily add a lot of new information, partially because the team is changing then over the rest of the season. But 20 games is, you know, it's starting to flatten out that curve and you're not learning a whole lot new with each extra game. But it feels like this year in particular, we know less about teams after 20 games than usual.
Do we or do we not? I mean, that's my point here. So I'm going to talk to you 6 weeks in about the Western Conference standings. Actually, we'll go over both, but the Western Conference standings, maybe we do know. I mean, you know, some of this is going to be a little bit of an outlier, but maybe not, and that's the point. So the number one team in the Western Conference is the Los Angeles
Clippers.
Andrew Hahn, who predicted that they would win 50 games last year. This year predicted they would not make the playoffs, which was a reasonable prediction. The other Clippers, after winning in Portland last night, where they shot the ball terribly. You didn't go to that game, did you, Kevin?
No, I didn't make it down for that one.
Okay. I don't blame you. The Clippers win in Portland last night. Portland all of a sudden is slipped all the way to sixth in the league. They were like first a couple weeks ago or a couple days ago. Anyway, Clippers are 13-6, buoyed by a tremendous record at Staples Center. They're 8-1 at home. And they are the number one team in the standings in the Western Conference. You know, they've played 19 games into the season. A couple other teams have played 20. The Warriors are essentially tied with them. They're a couple percentage points behind. But, You know, they're 14-7. They've got the most wins in the conference. But, you know, because we're not surprised that Golden State's up there. Maybe a little surprised that they've got seven losses right now. But and then in third place is Denver. Fourth place is Memphis. And Memphis lost yesterday at home to the New York Knicks. So certainly there's some variance that is going to happen. But we've got a couple of teams that we thought would be near the top that are down at, you know, 500 or worse. Houston's 500. New Orleans is 500. Those are both teams that we thought would be up there. Utah is under 500. San Antonio's under 500. These are things we didn't expect. And then we have Sacramento at 500. And, as I mentioned, Memphis is up there at 12-7, fourth place. So, Kevin, what amongst this is legit and what amongst this is not, you think?
So I think my first recommendation is if you go to the ESPN NBA standings page, it's helpful. You can go over to the point differential column towards the right and sort by that. And I think that tells you a lot more about what the standings are going to look like at the end of the season than looking at the, you know, looking at it by record right now. And it makes a bit more sense when you do that. The Warriors are still third. I mean, I feel like they're the team we have the best handle on because we know that they're amazing when Steph Curry plays and pretty mediocre when he doesn't. And Steph Curry is probably going to play more games going forward than he has so far. So they're going to be fine. But, you know, then Memphis drops to fifth. There's a sizable gap now between them and the top four in the conference. Sacramento drops to 13th. They've not really played quite as well as that 500 record makes it look. But you still do have some of these things that are quite surprising. The Clippers being fourth and right there in the mix with anyone else, with Denver atop the conference by that measure. And then the Houston and Utah being, by that measure, 11th and 12th in the conference. And it seemed for a moment, this is kind of what I want to talk about. It seemed for a minute like Houston had kind of righted the ship after Carmelo got excised from the rotation, and they won several games at home. James Harden was back. The offense was cooking. And then they go lose both ends of a road back-to-back in Detroit and Cleveland. Yes. And all of a sudden, is this just who the Rockets are?
Well, Chris Paul sat out the game in Cleveland, and Harden had 40, and they still didn't win. Colin Sexton, I want to point out that Colin Sexton has been terrific ever since J.R. Smith was exiled. And, you know, J.R. had taken some shots at Colin, specifically his three-point shooting. I was at the game, the Lakers-Cavs game last week in Cleveland. When he shoots the ball, it looks like he's shooting that, like, Derrick Rose 4-pound ball, because, like, the ball seems like it doesn't come off his hand real clean. It doesn't look like he's got a refined shot, but it's going in. But that's neither here nor there. He had the best game of his young career against the Rockets without Chris Paul on the court the other night. But, yes, and I would also point out, and Royce, the Thunder, who are 12-7, they are second in the West in point differential, to use the Pelton standings, which is what we're going to call them, and I think like fourth in the league overall, with coming into the week as the number one defense in the league. I think they caught the Celtics for that. Despite Russell Westbrook both being hurt and not really having that much of a Westbrook season so far. And, I mean, they are where we thought they would be in terms of the standings. You know, they're up there in the top four in the West, and they're doing some things really well. But considering how they got there, I would say that out of everything, they've weathered the storm really, really well and are really positioned to do well going forward. So give us your evaluation of the team you cover, the Thunder, right now.
Yeah, they've won 12 out of the last 15. They did lose to the Nuggets the other night in kind of a weird it was a weird game, Brian. Like, you know, it was the second night of a back-to-back, but it was
there are no weird games. There are just regular NBA games.
That's true. So. I guess that's fair. But it was an unusual setting in terms of that it was a home back-to-back, and other than the lockout season, that's never happened in Oklahoma City. I don't know if that really had that much of an impact, but it did kind of feel weird at the arena. Maybe that's just me personally. Maybe I'm the only one that felt that way. But the Thunder shot the ball horribly in that game, and but overall, I mean, look, yeah, they played excellent defense. They've basically reworked their defensive scheme. You know, last year they were a top five defensive team, And then Andre Roberson got hurt, and they basically fell to like, I think, I don't know what, Pelton may remember what they finished overall, but I mean, after the injury, they were somewhere in the 15 to 20 range in terms of defensive efficiency. So they really just didn't know how to defend all that well without one of the league's best individual defenders. And they've solved that issue, basically this year. And a lot of that's been kind of a scheme adjustment. They're really focused on the 3-point line a lot more than they've been. Billy Donovan talked about it the other day. They're not allowing teams to score at the rim, but they're not doing everything humanly possible to contest teams at the rim. They're just kind of, you know, they're not sending second and third defenders and help rotations at the rim. They're trying to make sure that they handle the 3-point line better. But, yeah, I mean, Paul George has played, you know, he's not the leading candidate for MVP, but if you want to do the proverbial MVP conversation thing, you could probably throw Paul George's name in that mix right now with the way that he's played so far this season. But they played pretty well. They've got two pretty easy games coming up this week. I say that they got to battle Colin Sexton and the Cavs on Wednesday.
That's right. So they're red hot.
There's no gimmies there. There's no gimmies there. can't just assume anything against the Cavs right now.
In that game against Denver, Westbrook had a poor shooting game. He was 6 of 23 overall, 1 of 12 from 3-point range. Now, can I just say real quick before we talk about what happened after the game, what the hell is Russell Westbrook doing taking 12 3-pointers? And I didn't see the game, okay? So I can't comment. I'm looking back. He had a game last year at Memphis. I don't know if you were at that game.
Yeah, 1 of 12, yeah. Overtime game, though, wasn't it?
That was unacceptable. I'm trying to look to see if he's ever...
I think the Memphis game's the only other time. I think that is it.
What the hell is he doing taking 12 3-pointers in a game?
Look, so, okay, here's the thing. And I part of me wonders, Brian, and not to inflate my own sense of ego here, but, like, I literally had written twice in the last, like, week about how Westbrook – because this is the truth. He has really tried to kind of evolve himself. He's bought into kind of a new approach that Billy Donovan and the Thunder have tried to been selling him on to get off the ball more, put the ball in Dennis Schroeder and Paul George's hands.
Yes, he wrote a whole story about this that published last week.
Right. And then I even followed it up because he played a wonderful game against the Hornets on Friday night, 24 hours before the 12 three-point attempt game. Westbrook – demonstrated that beautifully in crunch time. He got off the ball, Dennis Schroeder hit the big shot, and it was like, wow, look at Westbrook putting this in action. And then against the Nuggets, it's almost like he was like, you think that's what I'm doing, Royce? Let me show you right here what I'm still all about. But here's the thing with Westbrook, and it is true that he is trying to kind of approach the game differently right now, but he is still himself. And when the Thunder are behind, that is when you see these type of games where the 3-point attempts just skyrocket, is because there's just no player in the league that believes that next shot is going in quite like Westbrook. And, you know, Billy Donovan kind of talked about how you have to hit singles when you're trying to make a comeback. The Thunder got down by 25 in the game against the Nuggets, and they were making this comeback. And if anybody believes in the idea that there's a 10-point shot, it's Russell Westbrook. He thinks that his 3-pointers are worth 10, I think, because he just wants to fire them up. I would say of the 12 threes, Brian, probably 10 of them were really, really bad. There was two of them. Two of them were like off of a catch and they were open. You can excuse those two, but 10 of them were probably pretty bad shots.
So here's the thing about Westbrook. You talk to scouts, they will tell you that essentially Westbrook has no interest in anything that Billy Donovan has to say offensively from the bench. That, and I'm not saying that what they drop in timeouts and stuff isn't the case, but they will say that Donovan doesn't even bother making play calls. And when Westbrook gets into that mode where he's just going to go do what he's going to do, there's really nothing that can be done. And, you know, you could make the argument that, you know, you'd have to be stronger with him or whatever. I mean, this is now what, his fourth season coaching them? I think you come to just an understanding that when Russell gets into those moods, there's nothing you can really do. And Billy has clearly instilled tremendous defensive principles into their team. But they do rank 19th offensively, and this is ultimately going to be an issue for them. So after the game, what did he do? Would you detail what happened?
Yeah.
So what time was the game? Is it a 6 o'clock start? What time?
It was a 7 o'clock local start. Yeah.
Okay, 7 o'clock local. So tell us what happened afterwards.
The final buzzer was at about 9:20, and the Thunder are notoriously slow in terms of opening their locker room and players being available anyway, but this was just on a whole nother level. So the locker room opens, and it's just a bad sign from the start, because the locker room opens and Russell Westbrook is sitting there at his locker still in full uniform and like looking at his phone, and it's like, okay, that's not a good sign. So I go to the Denver Nuggets locker room. I'm in there. I talk to Paul Millsap. I do some other things.
It's not
in
a
there.
Good sign because you should say that because he doesn't usually talk until after he's showered and everything.
Oh yeah, yeah. So. That's Thunder protocol. I guess I should mention that. The Thunder like to all the players like to shower and get fully dressed and stand in front of a whiteboard and like.
And why is that? I mean, I know the answer, but why is that?
Well, instead of standing in front of the whiteboard, Westbrook thing.
No, no. Why is? I mean, you know. Okay.
Why do they like to get fully dressed?
For the Thunder people who are going to listen to this and potentially attempt to call me and bother me, I'm not criticizing. I'm just explaining. Why is the protocol to do it after the shower and after they're dressed?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know.
Because they want them. They don't want them to speak with emotion. They want them to be completely flushed out of their system, so that they don't speak emotionally. And that is one of the reasons why that is the rule. And they do it in front of the whiteboard in theory to make it easier for the media to gather around so the players aren't crowded. But it just enables it's a better way to have the player talk less emotionally, therefore saying something that could be potentially controversial that would potentially cause an issue. All right.
And also Westbrook hated people congregating around him while he was getting dressed. That was also a big part of it.
Well, that's fine, but go ahead. Yeah. So go ahead.
So, so I go in the Nuggets locker room. I'm in there for a little while, go back into the Thunder locker room. Westbrook's still sitting at his locker in his full uniform. Some Thunder players, go through the assembly line there, go in front of the whiteboard, do their post-game interviews. Westbrook's still at his locker. It's been an hour. It's been an hour and 30 minutes. I mean, we're talking an hour and 30 minutes after the game had ended. And Russell
so the game ended
still
at 9:20, and it is now 10-something, and Russell Westbrook is still wearing his uniform.
Still sitting at his locker wearing his uniform. He finally gets up and goes into the back of the locker room, does something, comes back still in his uniform. It is finally 2 hours after the final buzzer had ended, and we are informed that Russell Westbrook, if we are interested in hanging around, we're welcome to, but he's going to go out onto the arena floor and shoot, and he's gonna go out there and practice, do some practice shooting. And we're welcome to hang around if we want to. And at that point, it's like, I didn't cover the lockout in New York, Brian, but I feel like it was probably kind of like they even had pizza that they like some of the Thunder people were like, we have some pizza over there if you guys want to go eat some pizza. But we were like, we're in it for the long haul, me and like some of the other.
So real quick, what is going on in the arena? Now the Thunder, unlike many arenas, there's no the Thunder don't share the arena with anybody. So there's no hockey ice under there.
Just standard cleanup. Yeah, it's just standard cleanup.
So like in a lot of arenas, sometimes there's even concerts or stuff that they would be changing the court over. But in this case, there was no changeover, and the court was left down, and the arena was probably darkened. So
they wanted to clear out all the people that were out there, doing the cleanup and the regular, concession stuff. But so it's about 2 hours and I want to say 2 hours and 10 minutes or something. And Westbrook has finally got his shoes.
Now wait
back
a minute.
On
wait a minute. Did you go in there and watch him practice shooting?
We were specifically told we were not allowed to, which I challenged, and I said, "Wait, we're allowed to if we want to. Like, there's no rule here that can prevent us to go out there on the court." But Russell was very specific that he really would rather no one out there taking video of him shooting on the court. So we respected those wishes. And did not go out.
So they cleared the people who were cleaning out of. They weren't allowed to clean.
There was nobody in the arena. At that point, though, Brian, I think everybody was done cleaning. They surely had to be done cleaning by 2 hours after the game. I don't know.
That's bogus. I mean,
you don't actually know that he shot post game. He could have just sat in the arena for X amount of time and checked his phone and come back.
Was he still in his uniform?
Yes, he was. I can confirm he did go out on the court and shoot. I do know that he did. I 100% know that he actually did.
That's I mean, you know, first off, the media should be allowed to the.
I agree, but I'm saying he may have waited so long though, Brian, and that's what he may have been waiting for the concession people to finish cleaning.
He was I promise you, he was not doing that. But that's neither here nor there. First off, nobody cares about the media waiting. But in terms of the in terms of not letting the concession people do their jobs and go home, I'm not the concession people, but the cleanup people, and I wasn't there, so I don't know. But this is ridiculous, quite frankly.
That's the thing, is that the trickle down effect of Westbrook's, look, this was all theatrical too. This was not like, oh, I really need some workout. You know, Westbrook has never done this before. He did it in Phoenix on the road during a game where he had this really, really weird game, and he did this kind of theatrical, I'm going to shoot after the game.
There are no weird games. There are just NBA games.
sure. But I will say that he has been known to go to drive to the Thunder's practice facility after games.
Yes, that would have been totally what I would have thought. Yes.
Players do that sort of thing. But hanging around to do it on the court, that is a theatrical
thing. And in Phoenix, sure. Did he did it on the court in Phoenix, or did he do it in their practice gym?
He did it in their little practice gym that's next to the court. Yeah. So nobody was affected.
They don't have a practice gym in Oklahoma City's arena, so he had to do it on the court.
But that's what I'm saying. There's a trickle-down effect here. Oh, go ahead, Felton.
That was the sight of Kevin Love screaming at David Griffin, or that there's a famous story that you wrote about, right, Brian?
Well, that was a thing where Love got benched. It was the first year in Cleveland. Love got benched in the fourth quarter. The practice court in Phoenix is right next to the visitor's locker room. Literally the doors are side by side. And Love was still in his uniform, and he buttonholed David Griffin and pulled him into the practice court to have a conference about getting benched in the fourth quarter. That was long before Kevin Love's spirit had been broken, and he just accepted everything. That was back when he was fired.
And then who was the Suns player who walked in?
So Miles Plumlee, who didn't play in the game, comes down the court with a basketball under his arm to get some shooting up afterwards. Walks, and I can't see through the door because it's a steel door. But, I knew that they were just inside the door, and Plumlee walks into the argument or whatever was going on, does a 180 and walks right back out, makes like a face. So, yeah.
He did the, Homer Simpson, head.
Right.
back into the head.
Exactly right. Was it Homer or was it the grandfather? But, the Hedges. Right. Yeah. The grandfather does the reversal. All right. Anyway, Royce. Right. Anyway, Royce, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say that the trickle-down effect, as you noted, of Westbrook going through this whole show was, first of all, the reporters have to stay, which, boo-hoo. Who
Nobody cares about that. Right? I would have been tempted to just say, forget this and walk away and make a pact that we're all going to walk away. But his behavior was so bizarre that I think it demanded to get an explanation.
Right, it became news. And also, it was almost like it was a game of chicken, I feel, in a way. Because I think Westbrook was trying to kind of wait us out. And he didn't really want to talk, but he didn't want to do the whole did not speak with the reporters after the game. So, he was trying to put the onus on us. And it was like, we were like, we're not going to back down. We're going to stick in here for this. But we had to stay. And so thereby, all the Thunder PR had to stay because the reporters are there. The locker room attendant, who is this sweet man named Dean, this elderly man who's just wonderful, he had to stay because the locker room's still open. All the arena people had to stay. All the other interns and stuff had to stay. And so
when the $200 million player says he wants to shoot, the $200 million player gets to shoot.
That's right. And so finally Westbrook comes back. He honors the waiting, and he comes back in the locker room, still in his uniform, about 2.5 hours after the final buzzer. And thank the Lord he didn't go decide to shower, because he did break protocol, Brian. He did not wait to cool down after his shooting, because he came back in and he took off his jersey and threw it down and walked over and did his media. He didn't go shower and get fully dressed. So he did come over. And I will say Westbrook was not – he was not like curmudgeon-y. He was not rude. But when asked about the shooting session, which I thought Eric Horn of the Oklahoman did a great job of delicately phrasing that question, because you have to choose your words carefully in these situations with Westbrook. But he asked him, what is that? What do these shooting sessions do for you after a game? Does it help you clear your head type thing? And Westbrook just said, I'd rather not talk about it. And so that's what we learned about Westbrook's shooting. He didn't want
to. We should have spent the time looking at film and realizing that he shouldn't shoot 12 three-pointers under any circumstances. This happened with Kobe. One game I covered one time with Kobe. It was in Miami.
Kobe, yeah.
Yeah, Kobe had a bad shooting night. He went back out into the arena and shot, and the Heat kind of were not cool with it. They did it. They let him do it, but they weren't happy about it because I think they had some arena operation stuff they had to do. And the Heat do have a practice court at their arena that I'm sure they would have let him use had he requested it. Now the Lakers were staying in Miami that night. They were not traveling. They were practicing the next day. So Kobe went out and had a long shooting session after the game, then went through a complete ice down and everything afterwards, and then the next day took practice off for rest, which I thought was interesting. And that was back in the days when people didn't take all these time stuff off for rest. But
this definitely popularized it, because I'm reading our buddy Dave McMenamin's story about this from that night when his first stint covering the Lakers. And this is how I remember it too. It was novel at the time that someone would go out and take shots after the court. And now it's kind of, you know, it's going to happen multiple times per season. It's become this performative part of being an NBA star.
Right. Look how much I care. I care so much. I have to fix it. But here's the thing. Like, I don't know what Westbrook's true motivation. Maybe he really just did want to cool off, and, you know, his wife and newborn babies and 18-month-old son are not in Oklahoma right now. So it's not like he had, you know, needed to get home and see the family or anything. He might be bored and want to just sleep at the arena. I don't know. But I will say what it did was it just accentuated the fact that he went 1 of 12 from 3.
Right.
And also it made this November loss to the Denver Nuggets feel like a significant event, right? And so, like, the Thunder had come into the game winning 12 of their last 14. They're playing some of the best basketball in the NBA. They lose this game that you lose in an NBA season where you shoot the ball terribly and it's a bad game. And now it feels like this newsy event where, like, Westbrook blows up and he, you know, has this thing after the game and all this stuff. And so it was just not a good look, I think, for anybody involved.
Let's have a vote. Should I tell a Sasha Pavlovich story?
Yes.
Is that a waste of time?
Who's going to vote Andrew no Hahn, on Sasha Pavlovich story?
Andrew Hahn, should I tell a Sasha Pavlovich story?
You should tell every Sasha Pavlovich story.
Okay. And Pelton and you and Royce still just voted yes. I'd ask Kyrie back in Bristol, but he's already outvoted, even if he says no. He's probably like, oh, no, I don't want to edit it.
But yes.
Okay, Kyrie says yes. So Sasha Pavlovich was not known as the hardest worker in the history of the NBA. In fact, he was routinely the first guy out of practice and the first guy out of the locker room after every game. And, you know, there was this one time Mike Brown was the coach of the Cavs and he won coach of the year, and they gave him the award after practice, after a playoff practice. And the team came and posed for a photo with him with the Red Auerbach trophy. And in the photo, there's 11 players dressed in their practice jerseys and Sasha dressed in a jumpsuit, because Sasha was already, even during the playoffs, had already gone and dressed to go home, and they pulled him out of the parking lot to film this photo. So this is how Sasha rolled. Well, every Christmas time, like maybe about the first or second week of December through the new year, Sasha's dad would come over from Serbia and stay with the family. And Sasha's dad had this cold, hard Eastern European stare that he would just do with nonstop. In fact, Paul Silas said to me one time that he made him nervous whenever he walked past him in the hall. And when Sasha's dad would come over, Sasha would completely change the way he behaved. And one of the things that would happen would be that he would, especially if he didn't play or didn't play much, is that he would go shoot in the practice court after the game, post game, because his dad was there and he didn't want his dad to see him, you know, coming out of the locker room like immediately that he didn't go in and put like in a post game workout. And then as soon as his dad would leave and go back to Serbia, like, you know, January 3rd, Sasha was back to first guy out of the locker room. So was that worth it? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I enjoy any NBA story. I was going to say, here's my final point on the Westbrook thing, though. I feel like you'll enjoy this, Brian. So the Nuggets left their locker room. Their first bus was at 10:10, and they were actually a little bit on the early side of it. And we did the math. They flew back to Denver, and they probably had their landing gear out before Westbrook finally talked to us. Like they were on the descent to land back in Denver before Russell Westbrook.
What night was this?
Saturday night. Or where were they going? They may not have been going back to Denver, but they had a whatever it was. We figured it out with it.
All right, I could probably look it up, but I don't feel like it. I could actually
just take my word for it, everybody.
All right.
Oh, when they landed.
Yeah, I could probably find out. But I've definitely been working in arenas where the team that I've covered is back home before I leave the arena. That's a regular occurrence.
Oh, yeah.
It happens in the playoffs all the time. So that was interesting. Shame on a lot of things about that. But so we had a little interesting event happen in the NBA over the weekend. It was unusual. I feel like this is one of those topics du jour, and I'm not usually a huge fan of doing it because it's on every, show, I'm sure, today on ESPN. But I don't know. We probably should talk about what happened between Greg Popovich and Kawhi Leonard over the weekend, if for no other reason than we haven't seen this back and forth between Pop and Kawhi since their little breakup. This was a big breakup. So Pop was giving an interview before the game. Was it Saturday or Sunday? Do you remember, Andrew?
I think Saturday, wasn't it?
The video.
Sunday. It might have been Sunday. I think it was Sunday. I think it was yesterday.
So Pop gets asked by an Australian reporter about Patty Mills' leadership. And then Pop, who I guess I hadn't noticed, shaved his beard. How long ago did that happen?
It was about a week ago, I think.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't notice that. First time I've seen Pop without a beard in a while. He's answering a question about Patty Mills' leadership, and for kind of like out of nowhere, well, no, somebody brought up Kawhi. They asked if it was, different this year, that Patty Mills' leadership was needed more because Manu and Kawhi and Tony Parker were elsewhere. And Popovich just sort of shivved Kawhi and said, well, Kawhi wasn't a leader. And he said maybe he will be a leader someday, but he wasn't a leader, that Manu and Patty were, acting as our leaders last year, etc. And then he was going to say something else, and he stopped himself. And Kawhi's actually responded to it. He said, that's funny to me, which is funny to me.
He didn't laugh.
I know, because, we love it when Kawhi finds things funny. It's so rare, but I don't think he was actually being serious that he didn't find it funny. And then he basically said, I guess I don't know what he was talking about. I don't necessarily know if it was needed for Popovich to say that. I do think he's being honest, and I'm not in the Spurs locker room, so I can't say for sure. But, a guy completely absconding during the middle of the season to go work out on his own, injury situation, whatever, I don't think that's necessarily good leadership. And so I kind of understand where Pop is coming from. Pelton, what do you think about that whole back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a more charitable reading from Pop's standpoint of, he was just honestly answering the question, and Kawhi, there's an assumption that the best player is always the leader, but I think all of us probably have covered teams where that player wasn't necessarily comfortable in that role, and it became to other players who were more experienced in the league, perhaps, even if they weren't as good players, they took more of that leadership role than whoever the star and the supposed face of the franchise was. Now, the fact that the way that Pop started the answer was with Kawhi and, kind of negating it, as opposed to talking about Patty Mills' leadership specifically and, starting from that and just mentioning it in that context that he was already a leader even when Kawhi was there, makes it a little harder to make that charitable read, but it may have been delivered more emotionally flat than kind of it looks when we read about it after the fact.
I think KP's got the proper perspective here in both regards of, I don't subscribe to this idea that your best player has to be your leader. Why does it feel like it's some sort of insult to say that a guy is not a natural leader? I don't think that Popovich, I think, maybe probably was trying to get a little bit of a dig there, just for the reason that KP said, of kind of focusing on that and almost kind of, bringing Kawhi up into that without, being really kind of provoked to do so. But I don't think it should be seen as such an insult to say that, like, yeah, that guy's really not the team leader. You know, like, I think everybody's got this idea that,
well, Kawhi took offense to it.
Not. Well, obviously,
it's kind of funny. But Kawhi's response to it is, "I lead by example," which is, yes, a version of leadership, but is not really what we're talking about here.
Yeah, right. He basically said, "I come on time and work hard," and
which is good.
It did also say, guys ask me questions about their matchup, or if I see something on the floor, I'm telling guys on the floor. But he wasn't mentioning a lot about what he was doing in the locker room.
That's called being a teammate, not a leader. So, he's a good teammate. You can be a great teammate, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're a great leader. And again, I don't think it's an insult to say that a guy's not necessarily the leader of the team. And there's this idea that he's the alpha dog. He's the franchise player. So therefore he has to be the franchise leader and the locker room leader. And that's not reality.
Well, I just thought it was interesting. We see mostly respectful talk between the two guys, and,
it was certainly out of character.
Yeah. Speaking of,
what's your take, Brian? I need your take. What's your take on this?
My take is I can understand why Pop said it, and I think but I agree with your point that the best player isn't always the leader. But I will say this: if you're going to invest $200 million in a player, which that's what the Spurs had in their lap, and they elected not to make the contract offer. Now maybe Kawhi wouldn't have signed it anyway. But you'd like to be able to know that the guy is a leader, and it's a rare negative thing that the Spurs have said publicly, and it's a little bit of a window about how they thought. But that was one of the things that happened during that summer. Is I kept saying, well, this is gonna take care of itself because they're gonna offer Kawhi the contract extension, and he's either gonna sign it or he isn't. This is the same thing I'll say about Anthony Davis. The Anthony Davis situation is going to take care of itself because Anthony Davis is either going to sign that extension or not. And if he doesn't sign it, they're going to have to trade him. End of story. And the thing about it was the Spurs didn't even offer it. And I kept waiting for the Spurs to offer it, and they didn't offer it. And that said to me a lot about where the status of the relationship was, because that was the I don't want to say the bullet in the gun. That was the ace that they held in their pocket that could have changed everything, because once he's traded, he can't get the Supermax contract. And not only that, there wasn't even a guarantee that he would be eligible for the Supermax in a year. So he was eligible now. He was highly incentivized to sign it to get way more money, $70 million more money than he could have gotten. And the fact that they didn't offer that with all of that in their favor, I think just said a whole heck of a lot about the way the Spurs felt about Kawhi. And I think Popovich just, started to trickle some of that out. And he even said that LaMarcus Aldridge had been a better leader than Kawhi recently. And I think that's one of the knocks that's been on Aldridge over the years, that he hasn't been that kind of player. So, and certainly Pop and Aldridge have not always seen eye to eye. So he just tossed that in one last little shiv to the side. But I just found it interesting that Kawhi actually responded to it. So that it got under Kawhi's skin. So it was regardless of the actual content of the back and forth, I think it was more revealing about peeling back the layers a little bit. I think that game is January 3rd. So I think that's the return game to San Antonio. So I will see if any more layers come off the onion between now and then, but it's an interesting start. So we had a Jimmy Butler game winner yesterday in Brooklyn. Philly had a bit of a shaky weekend. They lost to the Cavs on Friday at home, their first home loss. And then they were down the entire game to Brooklyn. By the way, Pelton, D'Angelo Russell is having a good season.
Yeah,
and he had another good game on that game too.
It's me and D'Angelo Russell are like haunting the Clippers. I finally jumped off the bandwagon this year, and now he's starting to finally come around to what I thought he could do for many years.
I don't remember. Was there reporting? Did the Nets even have extension negotiations with him?
I don't remember.
I mean, they had to have had
on
some.
That, but logically, it didn't make a lot of sense because of their position this summer. You know, I guess he could have potentially signed something that would have been smaller than his cap hold, but. You know, I think that they probably wanted to maintain the flexibility, and he probably thought he could do a lot better on the open market than whatever he could get now as an extension. So one of those cases where probably neither side really had much incentive to do it.
Right. Well, he's having a tremendous start to the season, and he had a great game yesterday. I think he had 37. And he's sort of one of these guys who, you know, is out there doing work and flying below the radar a little bit. Another guy who is doing the same thing, Nikola Vucevic, who had, I think, 31 and 15 on the Lakers yesterday. Did you watch that game at all, Kevin?
No, I missed that one. I was still watching football at that point before transitioning over into basketball.
I know that Royce was watching football.
I watched the last 6 minutes of it, though. I did see some of it.
I'm having difficulty with this JaVale McGee, great defensive player stuff. Because, honestly, I see that he does make really good defensive plays. He had pretty much a game, I don't know if it was game saving, but he made a block the other night in Cleveland. That really helped the Lakers control the game. But he still gets torched and embarrassed defensively, like, all the time. And I'm having difficulty. There's this huge groundswell of people talking about, like, him as a defensive player of the year candidate. And then I see Vucevic.
Whoa.
I see Vucevic literally turn him into a pretzel, like, four or five times in a row. And I'm like, what are we talking about here? But Vucevic is another guy who's having a really good year, who's a free agent to be. Am I right?
That I believe you are right, yeah.
I mean, that guy is interesting. Anyway, he had 31 and 15 on the Lakers yesterday. The only reason the Lakers got in position to win that game, quite frankly, was that Luke Walton brought Tyson Chandler in, and they were able to get some stops down the stretch. It's hard for me to look at JaVale McGee and say he's defensive player of the year material when the Lakers were below 500 with McGee, and then they signed Chandler, and they're 7-2. Now, I know that that's a more nuanced conversation, that it's more about cutting the minutes, and there's a lot of other things that happen, but I recognize that JaVale is playing good stretches of minutes and making great defensive plays that are contributing to wins, but I just can't jump to the fact that he's a good defensive player yet. And I will just submit the tape from the fourth quarter yesterday if anybody cares. But that we were talking about Jimmy Butler. I'm on a tangent. I'm sorry.
Well, to round out this tangent, I mean, you know, really what was happening is the first couple weeks of the season, the Lakers defended quite well with JaVale on the court and were getting torched with him on the bench. Jonathan Williams this season has a 119 defensive rating that the Lakers do when he was on the court. JaVale's is 104, and then Tyson Chandler is 94.6. So I think that Defensive Player of the Year talk is probably faded.
So Tyson Chandler for Defensive Player of the Year. Is that what
excuse me, sir. It has not faded if you follow certain Laker people. But it needs to fade.
I'm not saying he's a bad defender.
Okay, well, he's doing really well. Let's just leave it at that. Jimmy Butler hit a three-pointer with 2.3 seconds. It was he made like a double move to create space.
It was like the Harden step back kind of.
Yeah, but he did like an escape dribble to a step back. And I mean, I thought it was reasonable defense. It was just a great play. It was the kind of play that they got him for, and I remember scouts telling me that, you know, Philly had been so, you know, stressed in late game situations because they don't have any guys who can shot create. Simmons can't do it. JJ Redick is limited, and Embiid, you know, it's a challenge for Embiid as a big to do it on the perimeter. And that they thought this is what Jimmy Butler would do. He's now hit two game winners. So Micah Adams, who used to be with us at ESPN, but now was working for NBA.com, but he tweeted out this stat. So that was interesting. And Pelton, I'll see what you think about this. When Butler played with the Wolves, which was like a year plus 12 games or something like that, he was 0 of 11 on game tying or go ahead shots in the final 10 seconds. Now, let me just say that when it comes to these clutch stats, you can change where you put the boxes. You know,
right.
He's 0 of 11 in the last 10 seconds, and then all of a sudden you say, you include you make it the last 5 seconds and he's 0 of 2. Or, you make it the last 22 seconds and he's, 11 of 22 or, whatever. So you can play with these numbers to make them fit your narrative. But that's a pretty good stat. He basically wasn't able to make these shots. Now he's hit 2 for the Sixers. So is this just a market correction or what do you think of Jimmy as a clutch player? Certainly he looks like he's paying off already for the Sixers.
I mean, it's interesting because one thing I was going to look at is the Timberwolves for this long period of time had a history of underperforming their point differential because they couldn't win any close games. And then Jimmy Butler goes there. And then last year they were third in the Western Conference before he got injured, in large part because of the fact that they were winning most of their close games. So I was going to give him credit for that, but maybe if he actually wasn't making the shots last year.
Well, that could be true. Well, just because you don't hit a game-tying shot doesn't mean that you don't play great in the last 5 minutes and instead of it needing a game-tying shot, you win by 5. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You can draw these boxes different ways,
True. Philly's, their performance with Butler has been fascinating. And you look at I mentioned earlier, starting the Western Conference by point differential, and I think it makes more sense when you do that than when you look at the records. In the East, I would say the opposite is true, where it makes a lot less sense because Philly goes from, being Boston looks a little better in terms of point differential, but Philly goes from being, third in the conference behind Milwaukee and Toronto, which is pretty much where we all expected them other than Boston being in that mix, to being, if you go by point differential, where they are even over the course of the season, they are seventh in the East behind both Charlotte and Detroit. And even when you look at
Jimmy
Butler got there. Yeah, which I wrote about after they beat the Hornets with that Jimmy Butler game winner in overtime last week. But even if you look at since Jimmy Butler got there, every single win they've had has been by single digits. They've all been close games, which I think is some of that lack of depth after trading two starters for one. But they've been able to survive it because of the fact that Jimmy Butler keeps making these plays.
Well, when you talk about point differential, which I know is an important way to judge a team, the Charlotte Hornets are maddening, and I know you wrote about wasn't the record 2-19? What was the record like a week ago?
Yep, it was 2-19, and then they did win a close game last week, but it ended up being more than 3 points, so it didn't count towards that stat.
But they lost a 1-point game to the Hawks yesterday.
Yes.
So the Hornets have the third best point differential in the East at plus 4.5, and they are 9-10. And to Pelton's point, the 76ers are flat, which means they have basically scored the exact same amount of points as their opponents. And they are
I saw a stat on this great little program called SportsCenter this morning. You guys were talking about the Jimmy Butler stats, that he was 0 of 8 on game-winning three-point attempts, and now he's 2 of 2 with the Sixers. So, I don't know what that means either, but it's a stat. It's numbers. It's numbers that you can repeat.
When the Warriors won 73 games that year, 3 years ago, I guess now, what was their point differential, Pelton? Do you remember? Or can you look it up?
I think it was definitely in double digits.
It was historically. Yeah, it was historic, wasn't it?
It was plus 10.8. Although San Antonio was right behind them at plus 10.6 that year.
And how many did San Antonio win? They won like
67.
Yeah, it was their all-time record. So all right, so 10.8, San Antonio wins 67 games. 10.9 or whatever, Golden State wins 73 games. The Milwaukee Bucks right now are plus
11.8.
Yeah.
11.8, and they are 14-5.
The fact that they've won so many blowouts and they haven't been bad in close games, but only okay. I think it maybe even thrown people off the scent a little bit as to how good this team is.
Well, they have had a lopsided home schedule. They've had the most home games played, like, pretty much the entire season at this point, and they've played five more home games than they've played away games. And this was one of the things that, you know, I think Doug Moe, we talked about Doug Moe a few, like last week, about how Doug Moe was ahead of his time in points per possession and stuff. Doug Moe always said that really the way that you evaluate the standings, like if you want to go to midseason and try to determine the standings, is you take home losses. What was it? Do you remember, you know this, Pelton? You take...
Yeah, it's road wins minus home losses.
Road wins minus home losses, and whatever that differential is, that's kind of how you project out the season. So if you look at that, the Bucks have four road wins and two home losses, so they would be a, quote, plus two. Then you look at a team like the Raptors, they have eight road wins and two home losses, so they would be a plus six. You know, so it's a way to try to evaluate how the imbalance of schedules go. And you look at a team like the Sixers, they have four road wins and one home loss. So, you know, they, you know, have a plus three. So they would technically be ahead of the Bucks in this regard.
The interesting thing is, and that's kind of one of the issues of it, is if you've played a really home lopsided schedule, well, you don't have a lot of chance to get road wins. So you can't really build that up. That's one of the limitations of that. But what's fascinating in this particular example is that Milwaukee has played a lot of really good teams at home, and Toronto has played a lot of weak teams on the road. So
Milwaukee's played some tough road games too. Milwaukee won in Golden State. You know,
So the overall strength of schedule metric I have so far this year, Milwaukee's been about average, and Toronto has played the second easiest schedule in the league so far.
Okay, good, fair point. I will say that Milwaukee has the number one offense in the league, and let's see where they rank defensively. They are sixth defensively.
They're fascinating, though. The Portland game the other night, I think that, you know, they scored 143 points, and I can't remember exactly off the top of my head. I think they were 9 of 39 from 3 or something like that. But, like, their ability to score points in the paint, despite really not being that good of a shooting team, now they put up a ton of threes, but they don't necessarily make a lot of them. Like, they're one of the most unique offenses, I feel like, in the NBA right now. And because I think that Warriors game that they won in Golden State, I think they had 84 points in the paint that game. Like, that's obscene. Like,
You have one of the they are the anti-Celtics. The Celtics can't get any points in the paint. It's one of the reasons why their offense is so bad. They have nobody who really wants to get to the foul line. They have limited shot creators. They have all this talent. And by the way, I was reading Tim Bontemps' story from Dallas. Kyrie flicked at the young kids again. He's done this a couple of times. It was kind of low key, but he was like, you know, I can't remember the exact quote. I'll get it, but I don't want to make this a Celtics discussion because we're going to have Jackie on later this week. Anyway, he did it again. You know, Kyrie is flicking at them, and anyway, so Micah Adams also had this stat. Again, I'll preface it by saying a third time, it depends on how you draw the boxes, but since the start of the 2016-17 season, and including the playoffs, Kevin Durant is 6 of 25 on game-tying or go-ahead shots in the final 2 minutes of games. And Draymond Green is 8 of 14.
Wow.
So, in theory, Steve Kerr, in any of those situations, should be drawing up, if you want to listen to that stat, should be drawing up, you know, for Draymond and not Kevin, but of course he never would. So my point in bringing that stat up is that, you know, Jimmy is doing, you know, he's been great, but these are hard shots for everybody. And just because just because you miss them doesn't mean that you're not clutch or whatever. But I think that Jimmy, you know, so my point is, and Pelt, you talked about this earlier, do you think Jimmy is legitimately helping the Sixers, or do you think it just appears that way because he's hit two game winners?
I mean, he's definitely, he individually is helping them. I think, though, that some of the concerns about the trade in terms of what it was going to mean to their depth have come home to roost, especially because it's something we haven't talked about at all. Markelle Fultz is now out of the rotation and not playing.
We're waiting for this doctor's
shoulder
report
exam today. Yeah. So now all of a sudden you're left with, even Jonah Bolden's hurt, you're left with like eight, nine rotation guys. And, you know, Furkan Korkmaz has given them some good minutes, and that's actually been really important for them because
they didn't even pick up his option. Is that right? Like,
yes.
They were at the point where they were like, yeah, we're kind of done with this guy. And he's actually helped them quite a bit. I don't know. I mean, you know, they are, you know, they're 22 games in, and they're harder to evaluate because obviously they made the Butler trade and now they have this issue with Fultz. But, you know, they are, you know, they're 14-8. They played the most games in the league, 22 games. They're, you know, they're in, I guess you could say they're, let's see where they're in third place. You know, that's kind of where we expected them to be, but I don't know. It's difficult.
They've won 5 out of the last 6, though.
Right.
They've all been close. All been very close games, though.
Yeah, it's difficult to judge exactly where they're going to be. You know, they get some cover because the Celtics have been so shockingly bad, quite frankly. And they have a game tonight in New Orleans, which that's going to be interesting. Anthony Davis against the Celtics, but I don't know. The 76ers are a team to watch. See which direction they go.
Well, they're one of many teams in the league that probably needs to make a trade.
They just made one.
I know, but it necessitated more trades.
The problem is that, you know, even if they have to trade Fultz, or if they want to trade Fultz, it's a terrible time to trade him.
Let's say they traded him, like hypothetically take the other salary out of it. If you could just take him into space right now, would someone give them a draft pick, or would they have to send a draft pick?
No, of course they're getting a draft pick. But you're talking about incentivizing because he makes $8 million next year or whatever, or $10 million.
No, yeah,
he would not be a salary dump player. But
okay,
could you get a first round draft pick for him right now? I mean, even protected. I don't know.
That's just crazy to think that it's to that point. That's just crazy.
Well, this is there would be definitely teams who would be excited about taking him on because they would say he is a potential to buy low with super high reward. Plus, you could control him for the next 2 years. You know, he's a first year. He's on his rookie contract. Very rarely do you see lottery picks of any stature, even if they're terrible, traded in the first 2 years of their deal. It's very unusual. Yeah. Because having a young player who has upside under a control of a rookie contract is so valuable. I guarantee that there would be a bunch of teams that would be very interested in trading for Fultz. The problem is they would be the poo-poo platter. They'd be looking to take advantage of Philadelphia. And Philly has burned through their assets to a certain extent. The Tatum trade and the Butler trade have cost them the asset stock that they had. They still have some, but, you know, they've basically gone through the bulk of it, and they can't afford to make a bad trade. The next, you know, they have to make a deal that, you know, adds to them, and I think that just makes it really complicated, regardless of what this report from this specialist is going to be today.
Phoenix ought to try to go get him, man. Phoenix, I feel like Phoenix should just take the chance. They need a point guard so badly, and like, you know, if Fultz figured it out, and you had Fultz and Ayton and Booker, I mean, that looks pretty good there.
Do you feel like Phoenix is a place where a player who's troubled can find
his way? That's a great point. But good counterpoint. But
I mean, it's probably a better place for him in terms of, like, his issue isn't, you know, like, he didn't play with, but, you know, they just had Marquise Chris, who also went to UW. His issue was he had to learn how to play basketball, and Phoenix was a terrible place for that. And so far, Houston hasn't been good enough, I guess, either. Like, Markelle Fultz knows how to play basketball. We just got to figure out whatever is going on with his shot.
Does Phoenix have anybody else's first-round pick this year? Like, I don't know.
Milwaukee.
I don't know if anybody would have any. They have Milwaukee's?
They do, yeah. That will pretty likely convey, I think we can say.
Yeah. Is it lottery protected?
Or is it still reverse protected this year? It is this year, yeah, it is reverse protected, so they will be keeping it, but almost certainly would convey in 2020 when it's top seven protected.
Okay. What was that trade? Bledsoe?
That was from the Bledsoe trade, yeah.
Yeah, Bledsoe, yeah.
And Phoenix, all right, well, they've shown a willingness to trade their extra draft picks to Philadelphia, so.
Yeah, there you go.
That is true. They already made one deal like that. By the way, I know that Zaire Smith has been hurt, so it's not really fair. But don't you think they could have used Bridges right now?
Mm-hmm. Bridges. What if they just traded Fultz for Bridges and just went and got him back and
made like not happy. That Bridges is tearing the league up, but like they could use a guy at that position well. Right now.
He's played pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a series of things go against them. I mean, the Zaire Smith story is in its own way, almost as bizarre as the Fultz saga, where he has an allergic reaction that has exacerbated the foot injury and probably will keep him out this season. And then also, as we talked about in the past, the Nemanja Bjelica situation, like they thought they were going to have a veteran in that spot, and then now they don't.
Yeah.
What a weird 9 months for the 76ers. Man.
Yeah. By the way, like, I don't know if you'd have to be a pretty in-depth basketball fan, and I'm sure all of our fans are. I mean, you'd have to be a pretty in-depth basketball fan to still be listening to this podcast at this point, but the Zaire Smith story. So he has a Jones fracture in his foot, which is never good. A broken foot, for a basketball player, bad, but you know, he's got that. And then he has, it was to a nut, but it wasn't peanuts. It was, what was it? He had an allergic response to sesame, I think. Sesame seeds or sesame oil or something. And he had to have surgery on the lining of his lungs. Like kind of an emergency surgery so he could get over an allergic reaction. And he's basically out indefinitely. Like, don't know when he's coming back. And, you know he's 19 or 20 years old. To find out that you are allergic to something at age 20 and that the allergy is so acute that it requires quasi-emergency surgery, I mean, that is a pretty incredible turn of events, an unbelievable scenario. So, and Kevin, you follow the college game way more than I do. I don't know the college game. I don't, you know, after the first seven or eight picks, I wait till these guys get in the league or summer league to see how they do. But there were people who thought that move was okay. The people that thought that, you know, getting the future first, the Miami first that the Suns had from the Goran Dragic trade plus Zaire Smith, they liked it. People thought Zaire Smith would be good for them.
I know people who thought that they got the better player and the draft pick that liked Zaire Smith that much. I was a Bridges fan, but you know, it wasn't necessarily, yeah. So it looks a lot worse in hindsight because of the fact that Smith has been unable to play for reasons that were totally unforeseeable back then.
By the way, it's your neck. Yes, Andrew.
I know that Sixers fans and I guess Suns fans love to hear this, but we need to get
okay. Real quick, Pelton. This kid of Japanese descent who plays for Gonzaga blew me away watching the end of the Duke game yesterday. Is this like a lottery pick type of player, or did I just see the best 5 minutes of his career?
They might have been the best. It might have been the best game of his career, considering the competition. But no, I mean. Yeah. You know, Jonathan Givony and Mike Schmitz, our draft experts on ESPN, have been all over Hachimura for a long time. And, you know, his statistical projections kind of lagged that for a while, but it looks like so far this year he's going to kind of match that hype.
All right, that sounds good. All right, thanks, Royce. Thanks, Kevin. And thanks for listening to the Hoop Collective Pod.